This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour today. We are ready to discuss the week in review. Our panel of trumpet writers is ready to look at all of the important events of this past week and give you the meaning behind them. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good afternoon.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Kieran Underwood.
Hello.
So, Germany's government, has crisis been averted? Some people say that that is exactly what's happened, because a new coalition may be in the works, that everyone can breathe a sigh of relief. On this morning's Trumpet Daily Radio show, Richard gave an excellent program on why that is false. He looked at the underlying realities that make that an absurd hope, and even some very relevant history showing just how dangerous a situation like the one in Germany now finds itself in can be. And we're going to start the program today with an executive summary of this morning's Trumpet Daily Radio program by going to the man who gave it, Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think most of our listeners will be aware of the dramatic news from Sunday. And we spoke about that on Wednesday's show, where you had this long drawn out, complicated coalition, no negotiation that all fell apart on Sunday. Since then, you know, we've talked about how there are no real good options. Everyone's kind of been running around, not knowing what's happening. And then yesterday, a new hope emerged for German politics. The senior leaders of the Social Democratic Party, this is the center-left party, all got together and they had a meeting that just went on long into the night, and they came out of that and they said they might be willing to go in coalition with Angela Merkel. So before, they'd absolutely ruled that out. They said never, no way. They were in coalition with Angela Merkel before this election. They went into the election. They got their worst result in post-war history. And they said, well, look, if we go with Angela Merkel again, we could end up just getting murdered at the polls. We could end up getting wiped out, or we could lose our spot as Germany's main left-wing party, so we're not going to go in a coalition. But you know, given the kind of the desperate nature of German politics right now and the way they don't want fresh elections, they don't want a minority government, more and more people have been putting the pressure on the Social Democrats to get things to join a coalition, to change their mind. And so now they've said, we'll think about it.
Well, you brought out on the program today that this is not the end of the road. This could actually only prolong things and make things even worse. Maybe you could just talk about why this is a really thin reed of hope that people are resting on.
Right. So we are a long way from a done deal. Where we are right now is the Social Democrats are thinking about maybe joining exploratory negotiations towards having coalition negotiations with Angela Merkel's party. So we're in early days yet, and the Social Democrats may well even take a couple of weeks to even decide that. They've got their party conference in the beginning of December, so they think they might wait until then. They might even have a vote of their membership, which, of course, that's going to take some time. So we could end up just getting Germany out of the news for a couple of weeks, only for them to turn around and say, no, we're not going to do it. Or they could enter coalition negotiations and then pull out, just like the Free Democrats did with the coalition collapse on Sunday. Because I think some of this false sense of security stems from the fact that Angela Merkel has been in coalition with the Social Democrats twice before. And so people are looking, okay, well, the Social Democrats are coming around to being in coalition with Angela Merkel. This is what we're used to. This is familiar. She's done this. Therefore, this will be easy. But that completely overlooks all of the problems that meant that they didn't want to be in coalition in the first place. You know, they're going to be going in these coalition negotiations a far tougher negotiator than they've ever been before, because their survival as Germany's main left-wing party is at stake. If they don't do something different than they did the last two times, then they'll finish up the coalition, they'll go into another election, and they're going to get abandoned to the Green Party by flocks and flocks of their voters, or the Left Party. And everybody involved is going to end up losing their jobs. You know, political careers will be broken. A lot is on the line here. So they're going to have to negotiate tough, far tougher than they've been before. Even if it makes it into a government, they're not going to be the same coalition partners that they've been before. They're going to be – they've got to prove to their voters that a vote for the Social Democrats is different from a vote for the Christian Democrats, mm-hmm. that it's not a case of – vote for the Social Democrats and get Merkel. They've got to prove that they're bringing the government to the left, that they're stopping Angela Merkel from doing right-wing things, which means they've just got to be way more difficult than they've ever been before. So, and then the coalition, the margin for victory or for this coalition is going to be thinner than it's ever been before for one of these big coalitions. So you're going to see, even if it makes it all the way to an actual coalition, which is a huge if. You know, there's several hurdles we've got to clear before then, and it's certainly no means clear that we're going to clear them. But even if they make it there, just because we've seen this coalition before does not mean this is going to be a stable one. And in fact, everything points to it not at all being stable. So, you know, worst case scenario, we're looking at they spend a couple of months trying to put a coalition together. It doesn't work out. And now we're looking at Germany having fresh elections in, say, May, and then coalition negotiations dragging on towards the end of summer. Or, you know, best case would be a government, but it would be a government that's much more wobbly than it's been under Angela Merkel until this point.
It's quite amazing just how much people want this to work out, and they're putting a great deal of hope in the very thinnest of hopes out there. But I thought you brought out some really good points in the program this morning, just talking about why this is such a dangerous moment, looked at historically. You even brought out that article from George Friedman, where he was saying how we really need to keep our eyes on Germany just because they're so central to the success of the entire European project. But maybe you could just give us a little bit of a digest of what George Friedman was saying, and then put it in the historical context and how this really does parallel what we saw happening in the 1930s.
Right. So the way a lot of the media is looking at this is it's just kind of a technical problem of negotiations, and that if Angela Merkel is a good enough negotiator and can get both sides to agree to a coalition and make the right compromises, we're finished. We've solved the problem. But that completely ignores asking the question, well, why did we have this election result? Why is there no clear election or no clear winner? And that's one of the things that the George Friedman article from last year pointed to. It was based on some regional election results. But he made the great analogy that German politics is just smashed like a plate. Instead of having one or two big or like two big parties, you've now just got a whole bunch of smaller fragments, and it's much harder to build coalitions with them. And the main reason why is you're having huge percentages of voters shift to these parties that reject the political norms, that even campaign against the political system that they're a part of, that are way beyond the mainstream. The Left Party on the left and the Alternative for Deutschland on the right. Now, these two parties are so far outside of the political mainstream that none of the other parties will work with them. And it's a great dissatisfaction within Germans that has led to that. It's because they want something very different to what they're getting, their economic causes that Friedman kind of focuses on. But if you look at especially, say, East Germany, where in the last elections, 40% voted for one of those two parties. If you're going to have a coalition that doesn't include either of those two because they're too extreme, well, then your coalition has to pretty much include everybody else. And that just can't work. A coalition of everybody that's not extreme, you know, it's unwieldy. It's people from the left, from the right. It's all the reasons why the Jamaica coalition negotiations failed. They can't agree on anything. They take forever to get things done. And in the 1930s, this is exactly what happened. And you just kind of got into this death spiral where these coalitions would form, they couldn't get anything done. So more people would vote for the extreme parties, which made the coalitions even more ineffective, which led more to the extreme parties, to the point that either the extreme parties got invited into government or just the political system ended up collapsing. And this is the same kind of dynamic that Germany's on. East Germany is further along than the West. But if you had anything even close to what happened in West Germany across the whole thing, you know, Germany would be ungovernable. As it is, Germany is almost ungovernable. And if it had been, say, 2 or 3% less for the mainstream parties, then there wouldn't even be a hope of a main left-right coalition. And so if we just look at this as a coalition problem and ignore the anger and the dissatisfaction below, then you miss that this is building to something that's a rebellion against the whole political system, and it's leading to the whole political system becoming dysfunctional.
Yeah, I really like how you you did a very good job of encapsulating a lot of what you covered over a 55-minute program this morning there. But you brought out just the fact that, say, a sharp analyst looking at this from the standpoint of what's happening in Germany today and viewing it in light of that history would be able to tell you this is a very, very serious crisis. But we have the additional benefit of looking at it from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, which shows where this is leading. I mean, history gives you a really good indication. Prophecy gives you an outstanding indication of just how dangerous this is. If you could summarize that aspect of it.
Right. Prophecy shows us how it's all going to end. And so there are some very specific prophecies, especially Daniel 11 and verse 21, for example, is one where, you know, Jesus Christ references this passage in Matthew 24 himself as, you know, one of the events in this passage is something to look out for when it's coming close to the end, when it's coming close to his time to return. And so that passage refers to Antiochus Epiphanes, and it's an ancient fulfillment. But you can tell, because of what Christ said, there's a modern fulfillment as well. And this passage talks about an ancient individual, Antiochus Epiphanes, but there's a modern individual that it refers to as well, a modern leader. And it tells us how he comes into power. And it uses the similar kind of language that would fit very well with what you see in German politics right now. He doesn't come in legitimately. The King James Version uses the term flatteries, but he comes in by other means than the leader would normally come in. And when you see a political system shattering, well, it's opening the door for exactly that. And so in the program, we went through other scriptures as well that just because the Bible is full of these scriptures that talk about this strong man. So we went through a few to prove that. But then we also showed that with all of those scriptures as well, they all talk about Jesus Christ returning and stopping him as well. So this strong man is, you look at some of those scriptures and they're pretty fierce descriptions, like as terrible as the evening wolves, a man that has no mercy. So that there's some terrifying descriptions. But at the same time, these scriptures are full of hope because they tell us, well, when that man is on the scene, Jesus Christ is about to return, and then he sets up his kingdom that is totally different to all of the ones that you have of man. So when we see politics, as we see politics right now driving towards that man, well, we also know that it's driving towards that event, Jesus Christ's return.
All right, very good. Thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll leave that there. We've covered that story, what Richard was just talking about. We spoke about that on Wednesday's program, just bringing you up to speed with the latest. The same is true of this next story about tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. This week, the Saudi Arabian crown prince had some choice words about the Iranian leader, shared them with the New York Times. The Saudis are definitely showing some strong resistance to Iran's clear rise to power, but will it make any difference? We miss Brent Noctegal on the program today. No Trumpet Hour Week in Review would be complete without an Australian. So for this story, we'll go to Kieran Underwood.
Thank you. Well, I'll start off here just quoting a different article than the New York Times one that we mentioned. It's from Jonathan Speier at Foreign Policy. He says, Saudi Arabia appears to be on a warpath across the Middle East. The Saudi orchestrated resignation of a Lebanese prime minister, Saad Hariri, and Saudi officials' bellicose rhetoric after the launch of a ballistic missile targeting Riyadh from Yemen appear to herald a new period of assertiveness. against Iranian interests across the Middle East. So we're saying it looks like you're seeing a new assertiveness of Saudi Arabia, someone who wants to challenge Iran in the Middle East. And now we'll go to those comments from the New York Times, where it's showing exactly that from the Crown Prince bin Salman, his comments to this New York Times reporter who went over to Saudi Arabia. He had a dinner with the Crown Prince. He talked to him, and the Crown Prince tells him in English, he says, "We learn from Europe that appeasement does not work, and we don't want the new Hitler in Iran to repeat what happened in Europe in the Middle East." So essentially, he's calling Iran or Khomeini the supreme leader, Hitler. And of course, I mean, that's a pretty huge accusation. And Saudi does have a lot of power to be able to back up those accusations, to try and form an alliance across the Middle East to try and counter Iran. But if we go back to that foreign policy piece by Jonathan Speier, I think he makes a very good point in that while Saudi Arabia is trying to form this new alliance against Iran, really, Iran is still the king. And of course, this is something that the Trumpet points to all the time. He says, take a look at the track record so far in the Middle East. And he looks at some different countries, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. In Lebanon, a couple of months ago, you had the appointment of Hezbollah's Michael Aoun, who's very much an ally of Hezbollah, an ally of Iran. In Syria, just a couple of days ago, an Iranian official said ISIS is finished in Iraq and Syria. So you have these big lands where you can have people come in and take that vacuum. In Syria, Iran has finances there. Iran has manpower there. Then in Iraq, you have the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran coming in, taking that power vacuum as well. And then lastly, he points to Yemen, where the Saudis are trying to battle the Houthis. The Houthis are backed by Iran. And there again, Iran is sucking money from the Saudis, not doing anything. And at the end of his article, he says, then this is the scorecard of the Saudi-Iranian conflict. So far, the Iranians have effectively won in Lebanon, are winning in Syria and Iraq, and are bleeding the Saudis in Yemen. So you look across the spectrum, and on the news, you definitely will see these articles and headlines about Saudi Arabia trying to present an alliance against Iran. But really, who's still the power, and who's the king? Who's the one who's has much more influence in the Middle East? Don't be fooled by the headlines. It's definitely still Iran.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. We talked about this quite a bit on Wednesday's program with Brent, and I'd encourage you to go and listen to that interview. And Gerald Flory had that program recently, a Key of David program, Iran, the King of the Middle East. And it's also his cover story, or his from the editor, his lead-off feature in the new January 2018 edition of The Trumpet magazine, where it talks about just how much America's failure in the region, in the Middle East, has led the way and paved the way for Iran to succeed and to continue to rise in power. There are a lot of people who are looking at what Saudi Arabia is doing right now and saying that this really is hope for a better future, and even strong statements that the Saudi leadership is making against attacking Israel. But if you look at the bigger picture, you see that really is not anything to base your hope on. We appreciate that, Kieran. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Over to Asia now. China and Japan have been bitter enemies, even up to recently. They've had efforts to try to put those tensions to rest, but those have been pretty difficult, pretty strained, and the relations remain very cautious. But because of biblical prophecies showing that they will eventually come together, we watch for signs of that happening. Some of those emerged this week. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, one of China's major goals right now is the Belt and Road Initiative, or the One Belt, One Road Initiative. And that's a huge project designed to set up routes linking the nations of Europe and Asia together, with all corridors leading eventually to China. And Japan has not expressed much enthusiasm at all about the project because, as you said, Japan and China are rivals. And this Belt and Road Initiative would represent a big boost to Chinese power, at least if it goes the way they hope in Beijing. But on November 18th, Japanese Foreign Minister Taro Kono said the Belt and Road Initiative will be, quote, highly conducive to the global economy if it's carried out in an open manner that is available to all, end quote. So there is a note of hesitation in the remark. There's sort of a qualifier there hinting at the exclusiveness that Japan perceives in the Belt and Road Initiative, but it was still, for the most part, a positive statement, especially when compared to most of the other statements and policies that Japan has taken toward the Chinese project. And this statement was really well received in China. The Chinese really ran with this and just played it up in their domestic media quite a bit. They said they eagerly welcome Japan's positive attitude toward the Belt and Road Initiative. And the Chinese leadership also took the opportunity to extend an invitation to Japan to take on a significant role in the whole project. And then China promised Japan that it would be something that Tokyo ends up benefiting from quite a lot.
So this is not actually the first sign of a rapprochement between Japan and China in recent months.
That's right. Yes. In the last few months, there have been several moves toward a level of sort of reconciliation between Beijing and Tokyo. Back in July, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe met up with China's, now we should call him China's paramount leader, Xi Jinping. And that was when Mr. Abe first expressed the possibility of some willingness to support the Belt and Road Initiative. And then last month, Mr. Abe made a surprise appearance at an event at the Chinese embassy in Tokyo. And then earlier this month, Abe met with Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the APEC summit. And he also met with the Chinese premier on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit just a day or two after that. So there have been quite a few really friendly gestures lately between China and Japan, and it also all comes at a time when trade between the two is steadily increasing.
So put this in prophetic context for us. Why is this important that we watch this?
Sure. As China and Japan, they are the world's, you know, second and third largest economies. And as they are working together more and more, they're also both maneuvering to improve their trade ties and their other relations with Europe. And so this is very significant because the Bible prophecy recorded in Isaiah 23 talks about a trade partnership emerging in the end time between three powers, which are called in that passage Chittim, Tarshish, and Tyre. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about this trade partnership and who these three powers are in his booklet Isaiah's End Time Vision. And in that booklet, he proves that Chittim refers to modern-day China, Tarshish is a name for modern Japan, and Tyre refers to modern Europe. And Isaiah 23, verse 3, talks about these three powers working together in the time just before Christ's return to form what it calls a mart of nations. So that means just a closely integrated trade bloc. And the scriptures show that this mart of nations will operate in a way that ends up isolating and even marginalizing the United States. Mr. Fleury first wrote about this mart of nations back in 2010, and at that time there wouldn't have been very much evidence at all for this sort of China-Japan-Europe cooperation taking shape. But now, especially if Japan and China are kind of working to bury the samurai regarding that One Belt, One Road initiative, then it's easy to see how this prophesied partnership could very soon become a relevant force.
Burying the samurai, that's quite a picture. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that Richard Palmer has written a powerful article summarizing a lot of the recent cooperation between China, Japan, and Europe. That's in our October 2017 print edition. It's called Europe, China, Japan, the New World Order. And we'll have a link to that in our show notes. And then for an even deeper look into it, I would encourage our listeners to order a free copy of Mr. Fleury's booklet that I mentioned there, Isaiah's End Time Vision. So we'll have a link to that one as well. And it just does a really deep dive into Isaiah 23 and shows just how sobering this development is and how much hope and very good news is connected to it.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. A disturbing story now from America, where violence is plaguing a particular segment of society, a particular segment of the workforce. You have people fleeing this profession out of fear. Are we talking about police officers or border security? No, we're actually talking about elementary school teachers. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this story really hit national headlines this week, in particular in regard to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where, according to the Educational Association there, at least 45 elementary school teachers have resigned between July and October. And actually, according to the association's president, Jody Barksdale, even more have resigned since then. And the main reason they're resigning is violence from students. Actually, one first grade teacher at a board meeting reported that she says, "I have been kicked, punched, hit, scratched, and I've had a student physically restraining me in front of my other students in class. And I've had many of my personal things which I brought to my classroom that have been broken or destroyed." And that's just the first grade students in that report. The problem goes all the way up through middle school, with Barksdale mentioning later on that in her reports to the Associated Press that there's been like tables that have been flipped over, and this is just really something where teachers there are literally afraid to do their jobs, and this is obviously particularly bad there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. But it's not just one bad school district. The government recently released a report on violence in schools nationwide, saying that up to 10% of all elementary school teachers have reported being either assaulted or threatened with physical harm from a student.
It's crazy, the extent of this. Maybe you could give us some more information about just how broad-based these problems are in the United States educational system.
Right. Well, as I had mentioned, 10% of all elementary school teachers have reported being assaulted by or threatened by a student. But it's not just the teachers. There's actually been about 48 deaths on school campuses this year. 12 of those have been homicides. 20 of those have been suicides. And maybe even more shocking is 1.3 million disciplinary actions taken against students, like a suspended for a day or something like that, or suspended for a day or suspended for a season. Disciplinary actions taken against students for possession of drugs, possession of firearms, or physical violence. And so that's like 2.5% of all students in the United States that have had some disciplinary action taken against them for drugs or violence.
So many of these cases, the school, the classroom is meant to be a place where students can really focus on getting an education. And in more and more of these classrooms, it's ungovernable. It's impossible for the teacher to really focus on what needs to be focused on because of problems in behavioral problems in the students. How do you see this, the significance of this just from a social perspective? What's causing this, and what do we make of it?
Right. There's two main reasons behind this. The more immediate reason that would come to mind that would show why these problems are so much more prevalent now than, say, they were in the 50s or 60s is just all the legal restraints on teachers. Like I said, some of these students have been suspended for a day or even suspended for a longer term. But there's not much more than that you can do to stop a student from biting or scratching or cussing out or restraining a teacher. Whereas in past generations, there were much more stringent disciplinary measures in place that would make a student think twice about biting his teacher. Otherwise, that they knew that there would be a punishment coming that would make that not such a good decision for them. But digging even deeper beyond that, is that even if the United States didn't bring back some more stringent disciplinary measures, it might make teachers' jobs safer. but it's not really going to solve the root problem of is like, why are these students just so disrespectful and out of control of their elders at all? This is a problem that's rooted in their home life, that they're when you're coming in and biting your teacher or restraining your teacher in front of your class, there's obviously no fear of the teacher there, but there's also some much deeper child-rearing and disciplinary problems coming from the home.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that we've already mentioned the Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet today, but a little earlier in the book than where Jeremiah was talking in chapter 3, that chapter is actually entitled Why Family? And it goes through a lot of the prophecies contained in Isaiah about family. One of them in particularly coming to mind in Isaiah 3, verses 4 through 5, where he's describing the conditions in the end time due to rebellion against his laws, and then specifically says, "And I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. The people shall be oppressed, everyone by another, and everyone by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable." Is showing that there is, because of rebellion against laws concerning family and laws concerning just social cohesion, these children, they get to the point where they do behave themselves proudly against their elders. They have no respect or no fear for the consequences of what this type of action is going to bring about. And now you see the point where school teachers, they're even afraid to do their jobs. They're resigning. But then, like I said, if you get a lack of school teachers, these problems are just going to get worse. And as we're starting to see in America today, these problems, they're spreading out from the schools and into the streets with more rioting and more crime. The per capita crime rate's double what it was 40, 50 years ago. And this is kind of the root cause of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a terrorist attack in Egypt today, recent events hastening a conflict between the Catholic Church and Islamic forces, the state-sponsoring terrorist state of North Korea, and more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. The Week in Review.
There was a massive terrorist attack today in a mosque in Egypt, one of the deadliest in recent times, nearly 200 people dead. We're going to learn about this by going back to Britain and hearing from Kieran Underwood.
Yes, the reports came out initially. It was about 50 people who had died. Then it went up to 155. The latest is about 184. And I'm sure by the time you hear this, there'll be even more than that. And this was because of a terrorist attack in the, sort of the north of the Sinai region in Egypt. And you essentially have people walking into a mosque there, blowing up the mosque, and then shooting people as they come out of it as well. This is particularly bad for Egypt at a time where their president, al-Sisi, does not have a huge support, is trying to work on huge measures to secularize the country, and he's not very stable, and then you have this massive terrorist attack. So we don't know all the details right now. We just know the basics, but I think it would be a good time to point to some of the things that we have said in the past. Statements from the editor of The Trumpet, Gerald Flurry, saying about Egypt, he says, "Certainly as discontent with the political system in Egypt increases, we can expect to see the Islamists grow in popularity." And then he points to what happened last time with the Muslim Brotherhood, which of course we expect there in the future again for Egypt to go back to some type of Muslim control rather than the secularism we see under el-Sisi, eventually being allied with Iran. In his booklet, Mr. Gerald Flurry says, the booklet King of the South, he says that the scripture in Daniel 11:42 implies that Egypt would be allied with the King of the South, or Iran, meaning there's going to be far-reaching changes in Egyptian politics. We saw it before around 2011, and we're definitely going to see something in the past. And something like this terrorist attack that we've just seen, huge one, is the type of events that are on the pathway to those changes.
All right, Kieran, I'd like to switch gears a little bit here. Kieran has an article on thetrumpet.com this week about a very provocative message coming from the Islamic State against a historical ally. Kieran, I'd like you to go ahead and just tell us about this.
Well, on November 14, so this was last week, through the Wafa Media Foundation, the Islamic State puts out this poster. The poster shows this man, he's driving in a car, he has a mask on, he's from the Islamic State, on the seat there next to him is a backpack and then a rifle and a handgun. And he's driving towards St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican City. The title of the poster is Christmas Blood, So Wait. So that's the title of this poster, essentially saying, just watch out in Christmas. We're going to bomb St. Peter's Basilica, right at the heart of the Catholic Church.
So, this is obviously something very significant from our standpoint, just because we talk quite a bit about these biblical prophecies that show there is a major conflict coming between Catholic Europe and the radical Islamist forces from the Middle East. Help us to see it in that context, if you would.
Yeah, well, I think what's interesting here is that right now we seem to be seeing the end of the Islamic State. So you could take this threat from them, as a lot of people take the threats that they issue to, you know, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump and America and every country you could think of, and say, oh, they're just going to die out. ISIS is finished. But that would be completely naive. There's a quote from the former President John F. Kennedy. He says, a man may die, nations may rise and fall, but an idea lives on. And that's exactly what you'll see with the Islamic State. We've pointed to a lot of times in the past that the Islamic State really is a distraction, and radical Islam is not going to go away when the Islamic State goes away. Before Islamic State, you have Al-Qaeda, you have Muslim Brotherhood, you have all these different things, back to Muhammad himself, when he goes out and spreads Islam with the sword. So you have these ideas of a holy war and ideas of a just war on the Catholic side. And those ideas are never going to go away. And whenever you have a crisis, you're going to see those ideas resurrected. You see those ideas resurrected now with radical Islam. And what we talk about is that the idea of a just war against some infidel or some unbelieving Muslim was put into practice in the past numerous times. I mean, you only have to reference the Crusades to show just how prevalent that idea has been in crises. When they need it, they resurrect the idea of a just war, of holy war, you know? So the Trumpet watches these ideas very closely. When someone like ISIS says they're going to threaten the Catholic Church, that's something to take very seriously, because historically you've seen the Catholic Church respond to those types of threats in a crisis with very, very, very heavy-handed measures.
Yeah, Kieran's article online is "The Islamic State is Threatening the Catholic Church." You can find that on thetrumpet.com. We're going to go straight into a related story, also pointing to this pending conflict between Catholicism and Islam. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is one that's captured a lot of attention within Catholic Church watchers in Europe. There's a priest, his name is Monsignor Mario Longhi. He works for the Opus Dei Prelature, that kind of fairly infamous, thanks to Dan Brown, section of very conservative Catholics. But he was a friend of Pope John Paul II, or Saint John Paul II, as he has now been promoted posthumously. And he has come out and said that the Pope gave him or talked to him about visions that he received of the future. So he said that the Pope told him, "Tell this to those whom you will meet in the church of the third millennium. I see the church afflicted by a deadly scourge, deeper, more painful, more deadly than those of this millennium." And when he said those of this millennium, he said he was referring to communism and Nazism. He said, "It's called Islamism. They will invade Europe. I saw the hordes coming from the west to the east." Now, whether the Pope actually told him that or not is one of those things I don't think we can ever know. But you do have someone now who is provably and demonstrably friends with the Pope, spent time with Pope John Paul II. And he's saying, "Well, John Paul II told me that we needed to beware Islam." This is very interesting for Europe, because when you look at Europe's relationship with Islam, Pope Francis is in a lot of ways the most conciliatory voice, or one of the most conciliatory voices, you know, saying, "Well, we should bring in more Muslim immigrants." He's less likely to talk. I mean, he's maybe not quite as touchy-feely as portrayed in the media, but you certainly don't hear him talking in this kind of language. But this is probably one of the most significant voices being added now to a whole chorus of other Catholic voices talking about Islam, talking about Muslims coming into Europe, a lot of it revolving around that migration crisis. So, for example, you've got the former leader of the Czech Republic's Bishops' Conference, Archbishop Jan Graubner. He was saying that his country should only have Christian refugees. You had Cardinal Dominik Duka, who is the current president of the Czech Bishops' Conference, saying the whole history of humanity shows how uncontrolled migration causes violence and conflict, as well as economic and cultural collapses. You have the leader of the Slovak Bishops' Conference, Archbishop Stanislav Zolensky, who said that we shouldn't forget that Christianity and Islam are, despite all efforts at dialogue, in permanent conflict. When one side gains the upper hand, there is always conflict. And then we've quoted a few times Archbishop Christopher Schoenborn talking about, will there be a third attempt at Islamic conquest, conquering Europe. Archbishop Luc Ravel in France has talked about Muslim immigrants taking over Europe through higher birth rates. So this is now just adding to this growing number of Catholic voices talking about confronting Islam. And like Kieran said, this is something that we're watching for. The Bible talks about in Daniel 11, the same scripture we were talking about earlier, about Europe clashing with a major Middle Eastern power. And so that implies that religion will have a strong part in that clash. Now, all those quotes came from an article that I put together for the previous, the latest but one Trumpet print edition, the November one called A Religious Revival in Europe, that goes into a lot of those prophecies. And then also we have our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, that just gives a really comprehensive overview of the history of the Catholic Church, the history of the Catholic Church with Crusades and Islam, and then what's prophesied for what's coming next as well.
Yeah, hearing all of these quotes from these Catholic leaders, you definitely could see these being statements that would resonate with a lot of Europeans. And a lot of the point that you make in that November article that you referenced is that there's not necessarily this mass exodus to going to Catholic church services and a real rise in religious sentiment necessarily, but there is quite a lot of sympathy among Europeans who are recognizing these threats, and particularly this, you could say, religio-cultural threat coming from Islam into Europe, where you do have the Catholic Church kind of presenting itself as the defender of something more traditional and European, and Europeans really do seem to be flocking to to that message. You could see the stronger that they stand up to this, the more in some ways they provide somewhat of a counterweight to the waffling that you hear from some of the politicians. And it's the same kind of impulse that is empowering some of these more strongly anti-Islam leaders in European states. So it is amazing to see the Catholic Church right in the middle of that mix as people are concerned about this rising threat. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. For a while there, it seemed like the U.S. and North Korea were in danger of starting a nuclear war. And it seems like that immediate concern has gotten tamped down a bit, but tensions certainly do remain. This week, President Trump announced that America designated North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism. To learn why and what ramifications it could have, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this designation happened on Monday, and it comes along with a whole new set of sanctions on North Korea. And all of this is just meant to ramp up the pressure on the leadership there in Pyongyang over its illegal nuclear and missile programs. And this is actually the second time that the United States has designated North Korea as a state sponsor of terror, with the first one coming back in 1987 under the Reagan administration. President Reagan made that call after North Korea had bombed Korean Air Flight 858, killing all 115 people on board. But then back in 2008, North Korea was taken off of the list by the administration of George W. Bush. And that was in exchange for some promises of being able to make progress on talks about denuclearization. But now, obviously, those talks have abysmally failed, so President Trump has put North Korea back on the list.
What reasons does it have for doing that?
Well, the U.S. law does require concrete examples of repeated support for international terrorism. And Pyongyang has done plenty more to terrorize the world than just with its saber rattling and all of these threats to use its nuclear weapons. Back in February of this year, the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, he had his half-brother assassinated. And the significant thing about that was that it was not in North Korea. So these have to be international acts of terrorism. They have to be conducted off of North Korean soil. And this assassination happened in the Kuala Lumpur International Airport in Malaysia. And then also significant with that assassination was that the assassins used VX nerve agent, which is a lethal chemical weapon banned by the United Nations. So that was one of the main reasons they cited. They also pointed to North Korea's cyber attacks, such as the big one that happened on Sony in Japan there back in 2014. So that is considered international terrorism. And then there's also piles of evidence that North Korea has abducted people from Japan, from South Korea, from the U.S., and one man from Canada. And Japan actually believes that as many as 800 Japanese children have been abducted by Pyongyang over the years. And as we saw back in June, after North Korea returned a comatose American college student to his parents, it's plain to see that they very often torture their captives. So there's a whole host of other North Korean activities that could also be designated as terrorism.
So for the Trump administration to make this designation, how could this affect America's policy toward North Korea? What's the greater significance of this?
Well, it just comes along with a new set of sanctions, ramped up pressure. It'll make it more difficult for other nations to do business with North Korea if they hope to stay in the good standing of the international community and be able to continue to conduct business with America.
And just looking at it from biblical prophecy standpoint, what would you say is the significance? There's not too many nations on that list of state sponsors of terror, but I was just thinking of, I think it was in a recent Key of David program where Gerald Flory, he said, I'm almost sick of the word sanctions because they just don't do anything. I mean, it really does show the weakness of the United States in some ways.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, this is, you mentioned that this is a very short list. The U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism at this point is the Islamic Republic of Iran, Syria, Sudan, and North Korea. So basically it's Iran and then three countries that Iran has a lot of sway over and has conducted a lot of business with. And In the case of North Korea and Iran, these two nations have repeatedly shown themselves really eager to use violence to change the status quo and to accomplish their goals. And as you mentioned, Mr. Flurry has pointed out that North Korea's involvement with Iran is really serious. He actually said in his new booklet called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And in that, he talks a lot about this relationship. One quote from it says, Kim Jong-un shares his nuclear power with Iran, the number one terrorist-sponsoring nation in the world by far. And Iran has a religious leader that is even more bizarre in the extreme than Kim Jong-un. He believes that a nuclear catastrophe would even hasten the coming of his Messiah to rule the world. That is a satanic counterfeit to the Great Tribulation and the Second Coming of Jesus Christ. These two men, meaning Kim Jong-un and then the leadership there in Iran, have changed the nuclear equation in this world. They relish the idea of a nuclear war. This is not fantasy. This is the real world. That's the end of the quote there. But then from there, Mr. Flurry points to a Bible prophecy recorded in Matthew 24, 21 through 22, which says that a nuclear World War III is coming very soon. And if any listeners have not yet ordered a free copy of that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, we'll be sure to leave a link in the show notes for today's episode. And that booklet just really does an amazing job of putting all this in the true context.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. We're just about out of time, but we'll slip in one last story here. Last year, drugs killed more Americans than the Vietnam War. A recent report from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention had some shocking facts about just how bad the drug problem in the United States is. To learn more, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that report highlighted that there are actually 64,000 people who died of drug overdoses last year, compared to about 58,000 people who died in the entire Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that probably gets overlooked quite a bit, but when you've got you hear a lot more news headlines about like terrorism and crime and things like that. But this drug overdose, as far as people dying from it, is about an order of magnitude greater than a lot of these other death tolls. And so the report really highlighted how the main culprit was the opioid epidemic, which I'm sure many of our listeners have heard sweeping through the nation. About a third of all drug overdose deaths, approximately 20,000 people, were from opioids. And even about half the opioid deaths from a particular drug called fentanyl, which is something that they've been lacing heroin with to make it more potent. That's kind of the pathway these reports have highlighted, is that a doctor will overprescribe an opioid painkiller. A patient will get addicted to it. Once they're addicted to it, I mean, the government's realizing that this addiction problem is spiraling out of control and has really tried to crack down on over-prescription of these. But then when you cut off the supply without cutting off the addiction, a lot of these people are turning to heroin as a molecule very similar to these painkillers. And then fentanyl is just a synthetic version of heroin that they're lacing these with, that's proved to be extremely deadly.
Any sense, just briefly, of why we would be concerned about this from a prophetic standpoint? It's certainly a phenomenal tragedy taking place in the United States. What does it say? What message does that send?
Right, and prophetically, and as we've pointed out a few times before, is that the drug addiction, it is actually listed as one of the works of the flesh in Galatians 5. It's a more umbrella term, but they use the term witchcraft, which in Greek is pharmakeia, which literally translates into the use or administrations of drugs. In ancient times, that was more common, to use drugs in pagan religious ceremonies. But even today, a lot of the people who are turning to drugs are doing it to fill a sense of emptiness or a spiritual void that's not being filled in their life by true religion. And so this is a symptom of just moral breakdown in the nation, but also a cause of a lot of these rioting and other things like that you'll see, is that not only are like 64,000 people dying of the overdoses, but then there's the violence that comes from the cartels and the gangs that traffic these overdoses. And this is something that we've also pointed out in prophecies like Ezekiel 5 about just your cities are burning, there's rioting in the streets, even escalating to the point where Ezekiel 5 says that eventually like a third of the nation, it's hard to almost comprehend that, but 100 million people would die in this rioting and this violence that's kind of linked in some, at least partially, to events like this, like the drug trade.
Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for Trumpet Hour today. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed in the program today. Let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Kieran Underwood.
Thanks for having me.
Fun program.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Robert Layton. What are our lame praises in comparison with his love? Nothing and less than nothing. But love will stammer rather than be dumb. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.